So I'm going to talk about, yeah, black holes and loop quantum gravity. And one of the puzzling and interesting aspects of black hole physics is black hole thermodynamics, as one observes it in the classical theory. In particular, there is this identification, if you like, of the surface area of a black hole with the entropy, thermodynamic entropy. And then one question to quantum gravity is, what are the degrees of freedom that correspond to this entropy? What is the system that is underlying this? And in loop quantum gravity, there is an answer to this, and it's very short. The entropy is indeed, so the area is indeed proportional to the entropy of something, and that something is a Chern-Simons theory that lives on the horizon of the black hole. And the answer is very simple, but it took a long time to develop all the aspects of this. And since I will be later quite bad in assigning names to results, let me do this like this. So here, all these people have sort of advanced the sort of the core of the description, yeah, starting with Lee already 15 years ago or more, and ending very recently. And then there's also a lot of actually work on interpreting and counting states and so on and so forth. And sure, I have forgotten people. Now, let me tell you a little bit more how the story goes. The calculation one does in loop quantum gravity is actually not entirely from first principles, in the sense that one takes the classical theory and takes a subsector of the classical theory containing black hole horizons. And one quantizes that sector of the theory, and one obtains results. And so the type of horizon that one uses is not a proper event horizon, because there's a very global notion, and it's hard to deal with in the quantum theory. So one uses the notion of an isolated horizon. That's a quasi-local notion of a horizon. So it's a null surface. It's foliated by trapped surfaces, spatial trapped surfaces. And there is some degree of symmetry on the horizon. So these isolated horizons are a little bit like killing horizons in that sense. There is some symmetry on the horizon, but they're not like killing killing horizons in the sense that there's no symmetry required away from the horizon, or even in for some components on the horizon. And for these isolated horizons, you can also derive classically laws of black hole thermodynamics. But the quantities involved are then defined quasi-locally at the horizon. And now when you do this, you get some boundary condition at the horizon. Yeah, I'll explain a little bit more what that means. The arrows here are pulled back to the horizon, so something happens to the fields on the horizon. And as a consequence, you get in your presymplectic structure a boundary term on the horizon. And this boundary term has, or can be written in the same way as, I mean, can be written to be Chern-Simons, SU2 Chern-Simons theory boundary term. And that hint from the classical theory one now takes and says, okay, go to the quantum theory, and I quantize the bulk with loop quantum gravity methods, and I quantize the horizon fields as a Chern-Simons theory, and then I combine them by trying to satisfy the boundary conditions, and then lo and behold, these things match up very beautifully, which a priori they don't have to. So the boundary condition links the curvature of the Chern-Simons theory on the horizon to some kind of electric field from the bulk. And now you might know from loop quantum gravity that this the excitations in loop quantum gravity are sort of one-dimensional excitations of this field here. So these are sort of flux tubes for this field. So on the horizon, this is zero, except for where these excitations puncture the horizon. And Similarly, for the transimence theory, you know that the curvature is zero, except for if you couple some kind of matter to transimence theory, namely some type of particles, which you can do, and then you have little curvature delta functions sitting at the locations of the particles. And so the picture, like on the right and left-hand side, is very, very similar. And you can go on like this. For example, the remaining degrees of freedom here in loop quantum gravity at the puncture are described by some operators obeying SU2 commutation relations. And similarly, the particle degrees of freedom that are sitting in the transimence theory have a description like this, so you can sort of identify them. And the transimens Hilbert space also has some nice interpretation in terms of loop quantum gravity. Some people have called this miraculous, so these two theories match so well. But I think we should not believe in miracles. So, sorry. We should ask, yeah, why is this so? And I think you agree with me that on a conceptual level, they better agree because it's the same field. Yeah, we're just taking the gravitational field. We are restricting some components to the horizon, but that doesn't make it a different animal. However, technically, what is done in this calculation is obscuring this fact because the horizon degrees of freedom treated very differently. So the goal of my talk is I want to try and introduce to you some framework in which one can treat both the bulk and the boundary degrees of freedom completely within loop quantum gravity. So I don't have to talk about transimens theory at all. Some kind of transimens theory will emerge at the end, and it will emerge from imposing the boundary conditions in the quantum theory. So in a sense, a little bit like a cartoon of what was happening was that conventionally one first imposes the one first looks at classically at horizons, and one sees there's the transimens theory. Then one quantizes. What I'm trying to do is I want to first quantize, like say this is loop quantum gravity, and then impose some condition on the horizon and recover what we know. So far, are there any questions? Because this, if nothing else, this idea of my talk you should take home. What comes now is a little bit more technical. Good. Then let's go. Very, very brief introduction. I'm sorry. Very brief introduction to loop quantum gravity. So there is also a covariant formulation of loop quantum gravity spin forms. But for the black hole, up to now, it seems more convenient to use the canonical description. And sort of special thing about loop quantum gravity are the variables, these canonical variables. Before imposing constraints, they look like SU2 gauge theory. So the unreduced phase space is exactly that of SU2 gauge theory. And so we have a connection, and we have something like a non-abelian electric field. And one uses, not in the quantum theory, not the point fields, because they are quite singular. One uses integrated fields. And the natural thing to do with a connection is you integrate it on path to get holonomy. Or you, if you want to be gauge invariant, then you take the traces of the holonomies. And I will denote this thing by W in this talk, W like Wilson. So these are kind of Wilson-type variables. And on the other hand, this electric field is dual to a two-form. So it has some density weight, and you can transform it into a two-form. And so natural is to integrate over two-dimensional surfaces in space. Now, from the symplectic structure, you get some sort of algebra relations. And first of all, there are some relations among these traces. They commute among each other, but there are still relations. Then these here are the canonical commutation relations. They now say that these kind of fluxes commute with the holonomy loops to give, again, a holonomy loop, but with some Lie algebra insertion. And then there are kind of surprising relations at first. they are higher commutator relations, and they say that in effect that these flux variables don't commute with each other. And they are necessary to make sort of this part of the algebra into a Lie algebra, and that's important for quantization, an infinite dimensional Lie algebra. So, and these relations will be important later. Now, one has a representation of these variables, where the holonomies basically act like creation operators. They create some excitations. The excitations are labeled by spins. And the fluxes also have some action. They act like a derivative. And one can do interesting things. For example, classically, the area of a surface is given by the length of this non-abelian electric field. So in the quantum theory, one can ask, is there some operator corresponding to that? And the answer is yes. And it turns out that these loop states, these spin network states, they are eigenstates for this area operator. So for example, if you have a single intersection like this, then you get some quantum of area. Now, let me come back to the situation in which you have a black hole horizon or something. So let from now on be like we consider some special surface in space. And I call it H. So it's a two-dimensional thing in three-dimensional space. And it should not have, H should not have boundaries. And it should be, or I guess it should be connected, orientable. So it should be a nice surface without self-intersections. And if let's, to stay close to what has been done before, we can even claim that this H is a boundary of the spatial manifold. Yeah, so that was what was done before, that the horizon was treated as a boundary. Yeah? But it is not necessary to do this, but you might want to think of H as a boundary. Now, we can split the fields that are on the spatial slice in terms of things that live on this boundary and things that are transversal, like the rest of the components. So the things that live on the surface are these pullbacks of the connection and the electric field. And where do they sit in this algebra? So the connection on the horizon obviously sits in these Wilson loops that lie entirely on the horizon. And the electric field components pulled back on the horizon, they are in flux variables that are transversal to the horizon. That's a little bit surprising at first, but that is because there's some dualization going on to form this flux. So these guys are in the transverse flux variables. The transversal components, well, of A are in holonomy loops that are piercing the horizon, and the transversal components of the flux are, or of the E field, are actually in this dual pulled back to the horizon. And the condition we have, yes?
So E was transversal.
Yeah.
Then why did it start at E, transversal?
Sorry. So you have a field E, and that's it's a vector field, and you pull it back to the surface, and you have the dual, which I define here for you. So it's really not it's really just making it into a two form. Nothing gets added or subtracted, but somehow you mix the components around. So the pullback of this thing is sort of transversal part of this field. So it's nothing deep. But it is important because the boundary conditions that we have for these isolated horizons link the curvature of this and the value of that. And that is kind of nice, because if it were these were canonically conjugate, then we would probably have a quite sick condition. Yeah. Equating the canonical variables. But here, this thing actually commutes with this, so that makes it tractable. Now, we have these boundary conditions here. So curvature of the connection on the one side and on the horizon, and the pullback of these, this dual variable on the other side, and they're linked. And so here I have already written what I want to do in the quantum theory, namely I want to basically put hats over the classical equation. I want to ask that, are there states psi such that this equation is satisfied? So the question is, can this work? And the answer I will give is, it can work, but there are two things you have to do or to keep in mind. And the one thing is that in this representation that I showed you, the holonomies are well-defined operators, but the curvature is not. And you can't take the limit somehow to obtain back curvature from connection. So the equation as it stands cannot work. But fortunately, we can express holonomies in terms of curvature that way. And that's the content of Stokes' theorem. So if the thing was abelian, then the statement would just be that to get the holonomy, you take the exponential of a surface integral of curvature. And in this situation here, it's a little bit more complicated because we have a non-abelian gauge field, but you have also a Stokes' theorem there. And the difference is that the surface integral is surface ordered in a specific sense. I don't want to go into too much detail, but I will say a little bit about this later. And the other difference is that you actually take the curvature and you integrate over the surface, but you parallelly transport the curvature back to some base point of the surface while you integrate. So otherwise, I mean, the holonomy transforms at the endpoints under gauge transformations, and so somehow the curvature has to be transported back to these endpoints all the time. But it is very similar to what is going on in the abelian theory. Now, when you do this on the left-hand side of this equation, so you do this surface-ordered exponential, then you have to do the same thing on the right-hand side. And so you get some object that I call WS, where S is a surface that is the boundary of which is where the holonomy goes around. And it's also one of these surface-ordered things. And then, provided one has this, one can ask for these boundary conditions. And then at least the left-hand side is well-defined. And the big question is, can we make the right-hand side well-defined? And I'll tell you about this. That's one thing. There's another thing, and that is, if you know about this loop quantum gravity representation, you realize that still, you know, even if this is well-defined, this psi cannot be in this vacuum representation of loop quantum gravity. That will just not work. So what we will have to do, what we're forced to do, is find states in a different sort of sector of the theory. So before I go to SU2 case, because there are some additional subtleties, but also some interesting things, I thought it was useful to give you sort of what happens in a toy model, in an abelian toy model. Because also in the abelian toy model, I can do everything I want because it's that much simpler. And after doing this toy model, I will come back to the SU2 case, and then I think you see better what is going on. Yes, Lee.
Yeah, this is probably a nasty question.
Yeah.
But in your classical C, you have a 1 over the area of the horizon. Yeah. Is that a classical parameter or a quantum operator?
Yeah, it's a classical parameter. So in that is one of the big things where it is not sort of quantum mechanical, but this is something that still comes from the classical theory, and it would be very nice to get rid of this. So I think it is fair to say that this parameter will not be terribly important in the quantum theory. So in some sense, I mean, the classical theory, this thing has a fixed classical area, but it looks like that the quantum theory can deal with horizons. I mean, your quanta is the classical thing that has a fixed area, but somehow your theory will accommodate all sorts of areas. But still, for some questions, this constant is sitting there, and I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, me also, I don't know what to do.
You don't know either.
Well, usually it's assumed just to be infinite, and so the quantum group deformation is taken to vanish. I mean, that's the isolated horizon work. But if you wanted to get results for small horizons, quantum units, you would have to worry about that. So I think what you're doing is much better than what's been done in the past, but
it's
still...
It's not complete. No, it is not. I completely agree. I mean, I have toyed a little bit with like trying to replace this by some quantum thing, but I'm not sure. Good. So back to my toy model. So the toy model consists in taking everything as in loop quantum gravity, but just setting the gauge group to be abelian. So we still have these fluxes, but now they're really like the electric flux. And we still have holonomies, but now they're they give results in U1. And the representations of U1 are labeled by integers and they're one dimensional. So our spin networks will now be labeled just by, you know, these loops, and then each loop has an integer as labeling the representation. And now I certainly have to do something by hand because this is not gravity anymore. I don't have some boundary condition, but I will put some boundary condition here. And in fact, nowadays we do SU2 fields on the horizon, but there was a time where it was thought very necessary to make some gauge fixing on the horizon to U1. And then, at least, on the horizon, you would have a U1 theory, and then these would be the boundary conditions that one would have there. So what do these boundary conditions say? They say that, for example, you have this horizon surface here, and you have a surface that is in the horizon, and you have a holonomy going around this surface. You also have a thing coming in, a charge network, if you like, edge coming in with a label n. And then what the boundary conditions say is that the holonomy around this thing should be determined by this n, to be this kind of thing. And I think there might be an I. Oh, no, the I is here, so there is an I. Everything is fine. So the holonomy around here is an eigenstate. This state is an eigenstate of the holonomy going around here. But there are other holonomies. Yeah, for example, the ones that are not closed here, and that is free. Yeah, that can be whatever it wants. Now, if I have a horizon that doesn't have a trivial topology and so on and so forth, so how do I solve this in a natural way? The nice thing is that so first of all, let us say we have now I'm just looking at the horizon for the moment, and I mark on this horizon some points that will be where these punctures come in, and so they are labeled by some integers. Yeah, that's the flux coming in there. And so this whole set of labels I call P, some puncture data. And now I want to find sort of a representation for the holonomies and the fluxes living on this, or the A and the E living on the horizon, such that there are these, such that I have a chance to solve the boundary conditions. And what helps with keeping what helps with the bookkeeping is that these charge networks on the horizon which are like their edges, path on the horizon labeled by integers, I can also view them as one chain. So if I have, you know, holonomy along E1 to the power N1, holonomy E2 power N2, I can just view this as, you know, these labels, and then I can also write it as a chain, yeah, some formal linear combination of path. And then gauge invariants of one of these charge networks is very simply, you know, the boundary is gone. And evaluation of a charge network on a holonomy is just duality between these chains and the one forms that helps in formulating the result. The second thing you need to know is that you can decompose every charge network in the whole space. You can decompose it uniquely into one part that is contained in the horizon and one part that is transversal to the horizon everywhere. That's useful. And then you can just write down the answer, like the kind of psi that you want to have on the horizon. Or actually, I'm writing it down for, I'm writing down a psi for the whole spatial slice. And this is a little technical, so I think I will not go into much detail, but just give you some ideas. So first of all, I'm writing down like some positive linear functional here because this is easier for me to, then from that I can reconstruct a whole Hilbert space and so on. And this functional is a product of things, and one part says that if you're away from the horizon, it's just what you had before. It's the standard Hilbert space. Then there's a part on the horizon that depends on this puncture data that says, and that encodes basically that whenever you go around a puncture, then the holonomy is specified, but if you go around a non-trivial thing, then it's not specified, and so on and so forth. And there is something here, a delta function on the boundary of the horizon part, which says that if you have just an edge in here, basically that it's free, that there is no condition on it. And well, you can write this all down. Now let me tell you so you can reconstruct from this now Hilbert space and states and operators and so on, and let me tell you what the properties of these are. The properties are that, what you expect, like so you have a ground state here in this representation, and if you act with a holonomy that is within the horizon, then if it's trivial loop, no punctures in it or no non-trivial holes, then it's just one. And otherwise, if it circles some puncture, then you get some non-trivial thing. And now what is interesting is that two states in this Hilbert space are actually equal if the charges are equal modulo k. K is some number that comes in from the boundary condition. And so another thing is that you have some constraint to make this consistent, that these charges that come in have to sum to zero modulo this k. This is all something coming out from this construction. What is very nice is that you can see that for diffeomorphisms that are fixing, that fix the horizon and fix the punctures and the boundary of a spin network on the horizon, the state is invariant under these diffeomorphisms. So as long as I fix punctures and let's talk the gauge invariant case. So I fix the punctures with a diffeomorphism, but I move my spin network edges, then it gives the same state. And if I move the punctures, then I can see that I pick up path-dependent phases. So I get some sort of anionic statistics for the punctures. For now, this was about the A. Now I should also talk about the electric field on the horizon. This was sitting in the transversal fluxes. And now, not all of the flux variables are still well defined on the horizon, but many are. So first of all, if you have a flux that is away from the horizon, then certainly the flux is fine. If you have a flux that is entirely lying inside the surface, it's fine. If you have a surface that intersects the horizon and the thing, the intersection is a cycle, then everything is fine too. And the if you count sort of the degrees of freedom that you have on the horizon, then the counting works very well in the sense that whenever you have a holonomy that's completely constrained by the boundary conditions, then there's no conjugate momentum anymore that has died. But whenever you have a holonomy that's not constrained, then you have a canonical momentum for that. So the picture you get is when you now you want solutions that are gauge invariant. And that means you have, first of all, you have to have these edges coming in to the punctures. And you have to couple them there. Otherwise, it's not gauge invariant. And so you have to then run inside the surface, inside the horizon, and couple all the things inside the horizon in a gauge invariant way. So in this abelian case, it works out that for a given bulk configuration, you just have one surface state. And for non-trivial topology, it's different because you also have these non-trivial cycles, and there are unrestricted degrees of freedom there. So then you have multiple surface states for a given bulk condition, I mean, even infinitely many. And if you look at this, you recover all the structures of a U1 Chern-Simons theory on the horizon. Okay, now let me go to SU2, the interesting case. The key object to do that case is this path-ordered flux, yeah, or a surface-ordered flux. So how is this defined? So there is some on so here's a surface. The surface has some base point that I fix, and I also have to fix a path system on the surface that connects that has certain properties and that connects this base point to every point on the surface. And what I'm integrating is really this flux field here, but it's transported back to this base point always along the path system. And there's some prefactor. So this integrand depends on both the A and the E. And this now the path ordered or this surface ordered exponential means that first I start with this E I have here is really a matrix. So I have these two form. So it's this star EI is a, it's a Lie algebra value two form. So I have some components here that are quantized, and then they are summed over with a basis of SU2, Lie algebra. The T's are basis. So really, I'm integrating a matrix. And now this surface-ordered exponential means that I start with the unit matrix. And then the next term is I have one of these fields here, and I just integrate it over all of the surface. And then the next term is I have two fields here, and I integrate both of them over all of the surface. But there is some constraint that sort of the one point has to be earlier in the surface ordering than the other. So there's some, I wrote this here as a kernel that takes care of this surface ordering, and so on for higher orders. So the question is, can we make this object well-defined? And this is work by me and Thomas Thiemann. The answer is yes, we can. So the first thing you have to realize is that this this thing here, this flux evaluated at a point, is usually in the literature, this isn't looked at. Rather, what is looked at are the really the integrated thing, the fluxes themselves, not this thing evaluated at a point. But this thing evaluated at a point does make sense. It's not an operator, it's an operator value distribution, but it makes good mathematical sense. And in particular, it factorizes into two bits. One bit that is sort of taking care of the sort of the tangent space aspect of this thing, and the other part taking care of the Lie algebra aspects of this. The tangent space thing, when acting on a holonomy, just produces like some form factor of the holonomy, like some sort of delta function smeared over the holonomy. And the Lie algebra thing really has these SU2 commutation relations. Yeah. And that will then act on the holonomy and produce this insertion. Now, you take this and you stick it into the formula that I gave you, and then you encounter two problems. One is that you see here this one part produces delta functions, and now you have this path ordering, and it happens that these delta functions are always produced at the boundary of the integration of this surface ordered integration, and so you integrate over only part of the delta function. You have to regularize this, but there is some standard way to do this, and that will give you a factor 1 over n factorial. And there is another problem, and that is more severe.
What is the n?
Oh, n is the how many. So let's see. This, I mean, this term effectively is an integration you have two integration variables, and the n is the number of integration variables.
So it's the order of the...
Yeah, it's the order of the expansion. Yeah, yeah. So the bigger problem is this here. Now we go into, we have a classical expression. This thing comes from the Stokes theorem, and certainly classically, the Ti are matrices, so they don't commute with a matrix product. But these components here, classically, they commute. They are just numbers. But in the quantum theory, they don't. So we have an ordering problem. And so I've tried various orderings by hand, and this would always give a mess. Until I remembered something that Laurent once told me, namely mathematicians have already figured out like a kind of best or most natural ordering in this situation. Also, other people have pointed this out. It's called the Duflo isomorphism, or also Harish-Chandra isomorphism. It's a thing in the theory of Lie algebras, semi-simple Lie algebras. And I will kind of describe it to you. Yeah. So for now, we can be general. Semi-simple Lie algebra, then what this map is a quantization map between two spaces. So on the one hand, you have some sort of classical space, and on the other hand, you have operators. And so to this Lie algebra, you have naturally two spaces associated. One is the universal enveloping algebra, and that will be sort of the space of operators. Yeah, you take the tensor algebra over this Lie algebra, but then you divide by the Lie algebra commutators. On the other hand, you have the so-called symmetric algebra, and that is you also take the tensor algebra over the Lie algebra, but now you divide by trivial commutators. So you say all the generators commute. But on this thing, you can put a natural Poisson structure from the structure constants of the Lie algebra. Yeah, so you can just declare that the generators that live here have these Poisson brackets here, where these are the structure constants. Whereas in the universal enveloping algebra, the generators have commutation relations with the structure constants. And so the question is, are there nice maps that go from here to there? And so the answer is, there is one map that is special. It is special in that it is as good as possible on some sub-algebras of these. Namely, you, on the one hand, you have the center of the universal enveloping algebra. That's where the Casimirs live, of this Lie algebra. On the other hand, you have a part in the symmetric algebra which is invariant under the action of the group. And these are both abelian, and so they have a chance to be isomorphic. And this there is this preferred map which really gives an isomorphism between these subspaces. And the map is a refinement of symmetric quantization. Symmetric quantization meaning you could just, given a function at like some object here, you could go over here and go through all the different orderings of the generators involved in your expression. That would be symmetric quantization. And so this is a slight refinement of this. So you take symmetric quantization, that's my chi here, but before you take symmetric quantization, first you change your classical object a little bit. Your classical object, so there are natural differential operators on, sorry, I should have probably written a T here. This is not so nice. So this is also supposed to be a generator of this symmetric algebra. And there are natural differential operators on these. Yeah, that just give this. And now, before you do symmetric quantization, you first hit your object in here, sorry, your object in there with a very big differential operator, infinite order. And it comes from taking some function and sticking in some function on the Lie algebra, actually, and sticking in these derivatives into this function. And you know, it looks very complicated, but if you like, you can just think of it as some kind of power series. So the important thing is that the first term is a 1. So to a lowest order, this doesn't do anything to your object here, and then you just do symmetric quantization. But there are higher order terms. This would be a second order derivative operator, and that will give a correction, and so on and so forth. So you get this map. And now, give you a very simple example for SU2. If you take you take just the norm squared of your generators in here, then sort of intuitively you would think this should go to the Laplace operator on SU2 here in the universal enveloping algebra, and it almost does. Yeah, it does up to like some constant term, and this precisely comes from these corrections. That is something else. That is what actually other people have suggested, that we use this. We should use this this quantization map in everywhere in loop quantum gravity. So area operator, for example, there's also this ordering ambiguity. And I don't know. Maybe that's the right thing to do. Maybe not. But what I do know is that in this context here, it is definitely the right choice. So this makes these operators well defined. And there are some general properties that you can guess from the classical expression. So if you choose suitable path systems on these surfaces, if you have a big surface composed by two smaller surfaces, then this can be written as the product of these two.
Define what happens if you take another ordering.
Oh, I mean, I guess you would also get an object that might also be well defined. Yeah, but it will, I mean.
So there's a property you have in mind that's nice with this quantization.
With this quantization, yeah, I mean, we will soon get some eigenvalues of this object, and then the eigenvalues will come out very nicely. Whereas if you use a different ordering, then the eigenvalues will be just some mess that doesn't mean anything. Probably. Okay, so you have these some general properties, and it transforms under gauge transformations at this base point of the loop, and now you can take the trace of this. So this is a matrix, but it has non-commuting matrix entries. And in general, for this whole matrix, it's kind of difficult to calculate because of this Boufflot map. It's difficult to calculate what this operator will do, although you know that it's well-defined. But if you take the trace, then things simplify a lot. So if you look at, so this state now, I should have drawn a thing, is supposed to be, so you have a surface, like this surface, and then you have an edge with spin J prime running into the surface, puncturing this surface. Yeah, and like, let's say, pick the magnetic quantum number M here, that doesn't matter. And then you act with this object, and then you see that it's an eigenstate of this operator, and the eigenvalue is this kind of complicated thing. Yeah, I call it lambda j, j prime. J is the trace, j is the representation of this, and j prime is the representation coming in. And, well, these eigenvalues are known. I mean, first of all, you can write them in terms of quantum integers, and they are related to stuff from conformal field theory, to the Verlinde coefficients of some rational conformal field theory. They are also known from quantum group theory. There are some components of the R matrix or the square of the R matrix of this quantum deformation of the SU2 Lie algebra. And they are precisely what you would expect for holonomy around a particle in SU2 Chern-Simons. So it seems that, so let's see what this means for black holes. So now let me say, let's say we have a solution to these quantum boundary conditions. What are the properties of the operators in this state? And then I will tell you about whether we have one or not. But let's first say if we had one. Well, for simple loops, like loops that would just go around one puncture, you have you have these eigenvalues. Alpha is the loop going around S. Alpha is the loop, yeah, I should have written an alpha here. So alpha is the boundary of S. Yeah, or alpha is just whatever. Alpha is just this loop. And then there's some other thing going in. And so in particular, if you have a loop around a surface where there's no puncture, then you get the trivial holonomy. I guess there should be a 2j plus 1 here, I guess. And you again have this invariance under diffeomorphisms fixing the punctures. You can work that out. You have like some equivalence modulo k again. Yeah, not all j's are different as when it comes to the states on the horizon, but only mod k. You have non-trivial monodromy of punctures again, and you also have some of the fluxes that are transversal to the surface that are well-defined. Again, those that you would expect to still be there because you haven't fixed the canonically conjugate variable yet. Yeah.
So, again, I'm a little fixated on this Their horizon is an integer in units of 4 pi beta blah blah blah.
Yeah. So there's some, if you like, there's some quantization condition on this classical quantity.
But does this match the? Let me wait for your conclusion though.
Okay. So the picture is again very similar to what I showed you for the abelian case, where you have these. So this is a gauge invariant solution. The edges come in to the punctures. They have to be continued here somehow to have gauge invariance. Ultimately, they have to be fused here.
Yeah. So I'm confused about the equation by the people that why do you have a quantization condition in your study?
Well, in fact, maybe I don't. Although, yeah, K is supposed to be the level of the Chern-Simons theory. So, yeah, there's no Chern-Simons theory. So now I'm thinking too whether I get some problem.
The Hilbert space will be more complex. If you don't get to mod out by mod, but you still have a Hilbert space, but it's much bigger.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Even we should discuss this. So I think for the sphere topology, it will probably not play such a big role. But I agree that for in fact, for if you have non-trivial cycles, then probably in one case you have infinite-dimensional Hilbert space, and the other case you have a finite-dimensional.
Yeah, but for an horizon which is spherical, isn't it?
Hmm?
For an horizon which is spherical.
Yeah. So there it should not make much difference. But I also have to think about this. I'm not 100%. Yeah. So the point is that I have drawn here all these edges on the horizon running into a single intertwiner. You could say, oh, but what if there are two intertwiners there, then combined by something running there? But the point is that there's diffeomorphism invariance everywhere here by the boundary conditions. So this is the most general picture. Everything else gives the same state. So given a bulk configuration, you have sort of the surface Hilbert space if you want to. I mean, it's all a big Hilbert space, but you can assign to the surface, if you like, the space of these intertwiners. So for non-trivial topology, there's something else that's happening. And so it looks like we would recover, at least in the spherical case, the results of this previous treatment. We have a theory on the horizon that has all the features of Chern-Simons theory. But this was all saying, if we find a solution, a state like this. And so do we have such a solution? I haven't proven it yet. The problem is as follows. So I can make a good representation for the simple loops, those that just go around one puncture. But if you go around multiple punctures, then these W operators, these flux operators, they start to link the punctures with holonomies. So they, in other words, in this intertwiner space, they start to change the intertwiners, and things get very complicated. On the other hand, I want to say by the boundary conditions that this W corresponds to a holonomy. Holonomies have a ton of identities that they have to satisfy. Yeah, these Mandelstam identities, which I've written one, but there are many, many. And so now I have this complicated operator, and I have to check all these identities. And for some, it can be done. So for example, for this one, which holds for SU2 elements, you can check that really for these Ws, this works out. But I'm not sure I have covered all the bases. I have all the conditions under control. But I'm hopeful. I don't see anything that... Yeah. Yeah. I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, good. I see. Yeah. Okay, then in that case, then there may be a problem, because then somehow maybe we don't recover the, then we don't get a representation of these holonomies. So let us talk about this, but let me try to finish, because I'm running over time. So so there is this question: can we really technically find this representation? And I don't yet have all the necessary results. There's one funny question that I have, is the question whether we have the SU2 transiemens theory or whether we have some slightly bigger thing, because somehow we don't just from counting what is left on the horizon, we have sort of more degrees of freedom. For each non-trivial cycle, we have a holonomy, and we also have a flux. Yeah, and so whereas in SU2 transiemens theory, I would just expect there to be the holonomy. So could this be point towards the fact that actually we have transiemens theory with a larger gauge group? That would be very nice, because that would be Euclidean quantum gravity. So we would say that there is really a geometric quantum theory on the horizon. But I don't know yet. Let me summarize. So we have a quantum description of this horizon in terms of things that are within the loop quantum gravity formalism, but modulo some loose ends. So there could still be a problem. In the toy model, well, everything goes through as expected. In the full theory, we have these new sort of flux operators that have some kind of quantum group structure in their spectrum, and it would be very nice to understand more in depth what they are mathematically. You seem to get non-abelian Schoen-Simons theory on the horizon, and to recover the picture for the sphere that was there before. Now, there are tons of things that one should do, like really make sure that we have a representation of the holonomy flux algebra in the SU2 case. Like, then the nature of the horizon theory. As I said in the beginning, your horizon surface may or may not be a boundary of your spatial slice. So in the case that there's something inside, then you can still count something like an entropy. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but you can do it. And the counting might change a little bit, because now not all the gauge flux has to go into the surface, but some can go through and go to the other side. So this is something one can study. There's a whole can of worms about spherically versus non-spherically symmetric case, because what I've not said is that the boundary condition that I used is, strictly speaking, derived for the spherically symmetric case. And however, sort of there is a very similar condition also for a distorted horizon. So I think at the end of the day, the picture won't change, and we are already in the quantum theory. We are already dealing with fully, possibly distorted horizons. That's something that was suggested initially by Lee and collaborators, I think. nothing in the holonomy flux algebra can create or annihilate these punctures. This is just, you can prove this because of the commutation relations of this algebra. So it's not possible that they are kind of fixed. So the question is, can you enlarge the whole thing to get something that can create and annihilate these area elements at the horizon? And maybe you can, certainly you can declare that there are some operators that do that, but it would be interesting to understand them as maybe some kind of limit of operators from loop quantum gravity, so that you can say, okay, this is a little bit idealized and we put a lot of energy there to create this new puncture, but I can understand it in some physical way. Now that the horizon seems to be formulated, the quantum theory inside loop quantum gravity, it's a fair game to ask questions about, like, what happens if the Hamilton constraint now acts on this state, that there's this solution state that we have. So there are questions that one can ask now, and maybe that's interesting. There seems to be something going on mathematically between this Duflo map and quantum groups, and maybe some expert will tell me that we knew this forever, but I haven't found in the literature something that says that somehow you can use this Duflo map to obtain things that behave like quantum groups. So this would be very nice to understand better. And let me finish with some kind of funny statement, but maybe it's not so funny. These horizons, if everything works out, they are kind of representations of loop quantum gravity, where on this two surface, there's some field concentration there somehow, and it's so much field is there, or something happens there. You can't just create it by putting a couple of holonomies. Probably you need infinitely many holonomies acting there on this thing to create this new state. But it looks a little bit like there's a brain there, yeah. So there's some very strong field excitation or some new field excitation that it looked like it wasn't there in the algebra that you had, but you can nevertheless consider, and the fields in your algebra can now, you know, couple to this new thing. And maybe this is maybe one can go further. Maybe there are other type of defects or objects like this that are interesting to study. So, sorry, I'm a little over time. Thank you very much for your attention.
Time for questions.
So I have several questions, but let's say one is about this SU2 versus ISU2.
Yeah.
So the thing you have not talked about on the surface is what you call the transverse E, right?
Yeah.
So which would be in fact the metric information, the intrinsic metric information on the surface. Do I understand correctly? Because it would be the E rho, which is the P.
So are you talking about the E that is pulled back to the horizon?
No, the one you're talking about. So which one?
I have all of them. So there is intrinsic geometry of the surface, which is...
Yeah, but on the surface, you can only take half of it. So you cannot impose everything, right? It has to be a Lagrangian summation. So I'm asking, what is the other component here? One is the holonomy on the surface. That's one component. And the
holonomy on the surface, and then you have that, if you like, if you have a surface that's transversal to the horizon, then it intersects the horizon in a line, and on that line lives this flux,
But I'm saying, is this flux the one that contains intrinsic?
Yeah, that's the intrinsic. That's the intrinsic flux. It's this funny thing where things.
Yes.
Kind of cross, because the
So then the
fluxes that are where the surface is lying in the horizon, that's actually the transversal.
So then it matched. I mean, we've done something with Alessandro where we look at the boundary condition, you know, revisiting the usual derivation. Mm-hmm. It seems that people have forgotten part of the. So there's in the derivation, there's really something which is really thrown out. And if you don't throw it out, In fact, you find that the phase space is not the one of Jan Simons, but it's a bigger phase space. But it's not exactly ISU2. The problem is that as in ISU2, naively, this phase space is going to be infinite dimensional. So, and this extra component that is being thrown out is exactly the information about the intrinsic metric on the surface that usually is treated as frozen. So it matches exactly what you're saying.
I see. Yeah. Exactly. Because in the, I mean, people actually make a big deal out of saying that on the isolated horizon you can have some dynamic degrees of freedom also, and so yeah, they should be somewhere in the formula.
Okay. But then, another question is, what is the meaning of this? Because here you were mentioned saying horizons, but really, you know, you're just putting these kind of surfaces, right, where you impose this boundary condition F equal lambda E, right? And lambda could be the area, or could be it's just a constant.
Yeah.
So it's like this, I don't know, domain wall in some sense.
Yeah.
But what's the, I mean, they're natural because they have all this nice property, but what's the rational or physical meaning for these things? Starting from, you know, if you just look at this boundary condition, boundary gravity in general,
so
what would be this?
I mean, so the boundary condition obviously comes from the classical theory. So that was my motivation, that somebody wrote down some boundary condition that at least specifies a part of what it means to be a horizon. I mean, if I'm very honest, if you do this canonical theory for the isolated horizons, then not only do you have this boundary condition, but you also have to specify your slicing in a specific way and your gauge.
And then there's something about the extrinsic curvature, and
There are other things, and I don't know how to encode them in the quantum theory. I don't see them. So this is, I mean, this in a sense, if I'm calling these horizons, it's kind of a leap of faith because they might not be. But sometimes I think in this history of these isolated horizons, the story is always that in the beginning we think it's very complicated, and then somehow people come and say, oh well, but it's the end picture is much simpler, and so maybe this is true too here, and that we. We can understand, I mean, that this may be part of the like a good picture, but I completely agree that I can't show this to you very nicely, that this is what it has to be and only what it has to be.
I thought for a long time that about looking at it sort of the opposite way, that is the condition that F is proportional to the dual of E. Is an equation of motion in the topological field theory that underlies the gravitational theory.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is I would almost take the opposite point of view, that is to start imagining that the space-time is in a phase where that is the equation of motion. And then it's lifted in some parts of the space-time, and you're left with a condition on a boundary between where the phase is imposed and where it's lifted.
But as he was emphasizing, it's a condition which is true for every surface, but it's only a two-dimensional condition. So it's not really a condition in the bulk, this F equal lambda E.
No, right. But if we were studying topological field theory, it would be imposed on every two surface.
It would be imposed on every two surface.
So imagine that we have a world which lives in a phase which is a topological field theory, and then part of that world undergoes a phase transition which lifts that condition,
mm-hmm.
and you're left with the boundary between the two phases, and this is a description of the physics on the boundary.
That's maybe the case. Then there's this extra degrees of freedom that everybody has forgotten so far, which in fact, you know.
Okay. Those are the degrees of freedom, if I understand, created by holonomies which are transverse to the surface but intersect the surface?
I don't know in terms of holonomy, because apparently there's no relation. They are just the intrinsic metric on the surface. The, and the assumption in any computation before starting with, is that this row gives the Gaussian field away?
The intrinsic or extrinsic?
Intrinsic.
Intrinsic.
The intrinsic metric is just frozen in every other computation. And in fact, it does carry a symplectic structure if you do the computation in SD.
Sure.
You just realize that with a Gaussian row. And it changed completely the picture. Because it means that there's this own, this extra Gaussian field that people have not taken into account.
And what's conjugate to that?
I don't know. It's conjugate to itself within the surface. That's the thing.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know about your computation. That sounds very nice, and it probably is not the same as what is happening here. But here, take the torus, yeah, and then what happens is that so you have two non-trivial cycles on the torus, and to each of these cycles you have a holonomy. And to each of these cycles, you also have an electric field that would determine the intrinsic geometry somehow. And this electric field is conjugate to this holonomy and vice versa. Whereas in SU2 transimens theory, you would rather have this holonomy is conjugate to that holonomy,
yes,
and there's nothing else. So this is how the additional degrees of freedom show here. But I don't know if this is compatible
It's more that on the surface you have E and you have star E. That's the key thing. So usually we talk about star E, but we forget about E. And E is there. And it's independent on star E on the surface.
Sure.
So, and it has a symplectic structure, and you can, it does carry its,
yeah, and somehow the fact that in my thing here that you get more degrees of freedom is that you don't quantize any symplectic structure on the horizon. You just quantize the loop quantum gravity symplectic structure, and so then there are more degrees of freedom there.
But what we did is that we can get the same result by quantizing the right symplectic structure.
I see, that's very interesting.
And what about this appearance of effective quantum groups here? What's the? I mean, here you get it in terms of this surface condition, but can you use this to argue in favor of quantum groups when there is a cosmological constant?
Well, if you apply the same thing, the same logic on a cosmological horizon, then instead of this AH, you have the square root, you just have the inverse of the cosmological horizon.
Not only the horizon, we're talking more generally on the body.
Yeah. So, for example, in two-first quantum gravity, you have an equation that's F equals lambda E, and then people don't know how to quantize this constraint. And maybe you can play the same game by taking the exponential, and what you should get, if you do things correctly, is the SU2 quantum group.
But why do you say we don't know how to do that? That's 2 plus 1 quantum gravity with a cosmological constant. So there is, one construction of that is as a transimens theory of SU2 plus SU2.
Yeah, but from the point of view of group quantum gravity, so
but
far...
That one, I know, not yet.
Well, they don't talk about the dynamics, just your
kinematical.
Yeah, but it's different. Yeah. You're talking, if you do dynamics of three-dimensional space as transcendence, blah, 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 then you get quantum groups. But that's not what happens in LQG. In LQG, there's no dynamics. So the question is why, and it's believed, and there's maybe some argument, why quantum groups should be the natural, kinematical realm for describing naturally, let's say, the cosmological solution.
In 3+1 as well?
Yeah, in 3+1. Using this type of...
In 3+1, because the semi-classical state is a phenomenal state, and don't shoot me.
No, but from this perspective, you see
there's
a nice appearance of quantum groups just from... essentially...
Yeah. For example, one issue is that in 3+1, you don't have transcendent theory. 3+1 with the cosmological constant. But but you still have some equation writing the curvature to the E field.
Right.
So then if you can play this game in 2+1, you should also be successful in playing it in 3+1.
Right, so I agree with that. That would be very good. I mean, the one small thing that can be said about that is you can do this game on a cosmological horizon. And then the area behind the cosmological horizon is fixed in units of the cosmological constant.
Mm-hmm.
And then you follow it and you get the relationship between the level k and the cosmological constant,
yeah,
which you get some of the
but you see there's something, I mean, like, happening there that somehow, you know, you get discreteness of the spectra of geometric operator because in some sense you're compactifying the space of connection. Like, instead of thinking about, you know, an affine space, which is Rn, you just take about autonomies, which are circles. And it turns out that if you, at the same time now, compactify, because what is doing the space of E field, so that you just take exponential, then, you know, that's when quantum loops arise.
Somehow you're compactifying somehow you're compactifying the I of ISU2.
Yeah.
And then you
get
SU2 cross SU2.
Something like that. So there's some kind of, I don't know, mechanism there that is working but needs to be understood.
I mean, I have probably been lost a little bit in this discussion, but I just wanted to point out that you can use the same technology, namely these W operators, to sort of learn, if you like, learn things about the Kodama state. Yeah? So you can because this E operator is also something like a functional derivative of with respect to A, and so you can claim that under the path integral, you can replace holonomies or traces of holonomies with these W's, and then you can throw them around and you can find out, I mean, it gives you relations, and it, for certain things that we have tried, it's enough to calculate whatever, like the Jones polynomial, some knots or something like this. So, but we have phrased this in terms of Jones polynomial and so on, but I think maybe it has an interpretation in terms of the Kodama state.
So, but just to speak in terms of Chern-Simon theory, can you go back a slide?
Yeah.
So, because, I mean, have you therefore used this Duflo map to give a precise definition of the measure of the path integral Chern-Simon theory?
It depends on what you. It depends on what you consider a rigorous definition of the measure. So strictly speaking, what we are doing is we are, we are trying to define some functional on, let's say, spin networks in general or something like this. We are trying to define a functional with certain properties, and it's by no means that we have found out that everything is consistent and this functional is defined on every spin network and so on, but it seems to go in that direction, that somehow this this thing replacing the holonomies with these W's gives you non-trivial relations among these among the values of this functional that then allow to in some cases just define the value of this function.
So you evaluate a certain class of operator products, of the expectation values of operator products.
Yeah.
And so, the construction of Witten was heuristic. He made a heuristic guess that this is related to the evaluation of certain operators in formal field theory. Is what you're doing, do you know the work of Froehlich and evaluating the Chern-Simon path by going to axial gauge?
No, I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, this is. I mean, the operators are well defined and so on, as I showed to you. But somehow there is no guarantee that this method will give you all the. Yeah, I mean, it could go wrong at some point. Yeah, and I don't know. So, for example, what we haven't checked is. I mean, we did this for the Hopfling, for example, and for simple loops, but for specific technical reasons, we haven't done this for knots. Yeah? And so could be that something goes wrong there.
So you didn't get skein relations.
Right. So at the end of the day, that would be beautiful. If we could just derive the skein relations, then one would be done. But yeah, I mean, maybe one can
do
it.
That's the point you were discussing, that now if you have two punctures, you need to have the figure.
Yeah, one has to do the same thing that Witten did. And then,
there's this tension.
You're right. And I think one can do that, and I'm hopeful that one gets the right monotony. But
what Alessandro was doing with his students, right?
I see.
They did this computation and trying to. And they also, they also find that they have to use the Duflo map. They want to reproduce the usual skein relation of quantum groups starting from.
True. There is another result like this. So just, I mean, here I was discussing something about the, something where you really deal with a three-dimensional path integral, and I mean, Laurent points out that the simplest thing would be to, kind of say something about the three-dimensional path integral by cutting and dealing in it with a two-dimensional theory, and that's possible, but we haven't, I mean, to a certain extent we have looked at it, but not yet fully. But you can also stay within this three-dimensional context fully and discover some things about for example, the Jones polynomial. The skein relations, I don't see how to prove them in this three-dimensional context. But then I would have to explain more what I mean.
If you have a rigorous instantiation of your top formula there, I mean, there are lots of heuristic or perturbative ways to go from the top formula to the skein relation.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. That's true.
So, I imagine Laurent said the issue is exactly the fusion of two punctures and getting the phases right when you fuse the two punctures. Anyway, it would be nice if we should keep
it. Let us discuss this.
Thank you, everybody. Let's have some rest.